Well, it's good to see everyone here this evening, and we certainly have an interesting chapter to study tonight. As I was thinking about what I see as the theme of this chapter, I was reminded of a conversation I had with Dennis Nilsen about 15, 17 years ago. I'm not sure exactly when, but we were talking about someone addicted to drugs, and Dennis said that if they're not ready to be clean, if they're not ready to be free of drug addiction, if they don't desire to be free, there's nothing you can do for them. You can't help them, they have to help themselves. And I've reflected on that over the years and how awesome wisdom that is, about how it is difficult to help people sometimes when they don't want you to help them. And that's kind of how I see this chapter. The people that don't want help in this chapter are the people of Israel. God has that problem with the people of Israel in this chapter. How do you help people who are comfortable with their oppressors? How do you redeem people that have snuggled up with their captors? Difficult to do. And I think the answer to that is that you send them a judge like Samson. He is the last judge. He's the last judge in the book of Judges anyway. And he is in the seventh cycle of apostasy and servitude. We talked about this earlier in our introduction. And here are the seven cycles of apostasy. And notice that in each of these, the children of Israel cry out to the Lord. It's not true here of the fifth, because it was an internal oppressor, Abimelech, who ruled as king. So the people didn't cry out to the Lord under that one. But everywhere else, the people cried out to the Lord for redemption, except for this one. And the reason for that is because the people are comfortable with the Philistines. And why doesn't Samson raise an army and fight the Philistines? Because no one will be in his army. Why doesn't Samson have a David or someone backing him? It's because they didn't like Samson. They rejected Samson as a deliverer. And I think we see that in this chapter. And I know this is open for some debate, and we can certainly have a debate tonight about this. But that's the way I see this chapter. I think this chapter is about Judah betraying Samson. And it shows how feckless, cowardly, and weak they were, and that they rejected their deliverer. And I think that's the reason why the rest of the book of Judges is dark. The rest of the book of Judges is very dark, and there's no more redeemers that come in the rest of this book, and it's because the people rejected Samson. So that brings us to question number one, which will be for Trace, I believe, if Trace wants this question. Why did Samson feel that he was justified in harming the Philistines because of this event? So he goes to visit his wife. And why is he justified in harming the Philistines? Because his father-in-law had given away his wife to his best man. And was this part of God's plan from chapter 14, verse 4?
The way I see this situation with Samson, is you can either be with all the critics and all those that just think he's a very flawed individual that's serving his own intentions, but you can just God is using him as a judge. And I think, his father-in-law giving his wife away to his companion, that's pretty much just like the case right there. But that being the case, and then he offers her younger sister. And I don't know, it's really messed up. But I think that God's hand is on this. But let alone that, I think he's pretty well justified. Any man in his shoes would be pretty enraged, I would. He probably does feel very justified in what he did to the Philistines and whatever he's going to do in the future to the Philistines.
Very good. Thank you, Trace. Other comments? Samson, yes, Lauren, Samson's justification.
It seems like Samson tries to make, keep the deals even, and here they've broken the bargain. You know, back in the last chapter, he honored his commitment. He made sure he did that, and he went and got 30 garments and 30 changes of clothing. When the Philistines answered the riddle, even though they cheated. So now this Philistine father-in-law has given away his wife. And also likely his, if we look back at verse 10 of chapter 14, it seems that his father probably paid a dowry for this woman. So he's out, his wife that he made his bargain for, and so now he feels
totally
justified.
Yeah, that's great. Those are good points there. Thank you very much. I hadn't really thought about how that dowry would play into it and how he had kept his side of the bargain. Other thoughts? Yes, Austin.
So it's interesting. I agree with Trace. I do think that the Lord is involved in this, or this is the continuation of how the Lord was going to cause trouble, because as we'll notice here in a few moments, the revenge that he takes is not personal revenge against his father-in-law, but it's national. It's against the whole of the Philistines as he wipes out many things. So I do believe that this is part of this, and this is the ending of a it's not quite the ending, I guess, but the culmination before he takes full and utter revenge on them. Because he's been hurt a lot, and sometimes I think we get wrapped up in whether his deeds were just or not. But let's consider Samson the human here. He's been cheated. He's been cheated out of a lot. Barnes had a really good note on this too. He says, before, when the Philistines injured him, he was in covenant with the Timnathites through his marriage and by the rites of hospitality. And the rites of hospitality are big deal back in that time. For which reason he went off to Ashkelon to take his revenge in verse 19 of chapter 14. But now the Philistines themselves had broken this bond, so he was free to take his revenge on the spot. I thought that was interesting. The young goat as well. That says something. He wasn't just bringing along like a dozen roses and a box of chocolates. That wasn't their equivalent, a young goat, but it was more so signifying what type of marriage he had with her, that it was more of a concubine type of a marriage rather than a full marriage. That's what some commentators said.
Yeah. Well, the scripture does call her his wife, which is interesting because the marriage wasn't consummated. So it's one of those situations where it's a little unclear, but she is called his wife. And I agree with what's been said. I think he feels that he has kept his side of the bargain. He's worked through his anger with his wife, right? His wife betrayed him, and he's worked through that anger. It's now spring, some months have passed. He's worked through that. He's ready to accept her back as his wife. And now everybody's against him. His family's against him. He has brothers, we learn in chapter 16. He has brothers who don't support him. The Israelites don't support him. And the Philistines don't support him. And now his wife, that he loves this woman, has been given away to a Philistine man they called his companion. One of his brothers wasn't his best man. It was a Philistine that was his best man. So Samson's alone. Samson's alone in this situation. And he's very angry. So I agree with Trace at the beginning. This is God's way of taking the Israelites away from the Philistines as much as they can. Again, they're getting amalgamated. The Israelites are getting amalgamated. It's the Borg. They're getting assimilated into the Borg collective, if you watch Star Trek. And if God doesn't do something, the people are lost. They're going to become Philistines. And so, yes, this is God. It's the deliverer. This is God doing this because he's going to pry them away from the Philistines. And The commentaries who say this is rash on his part are just missing the boat completely. God will do what he will do in our life. If you're a child of God and you're cleaving to sin, he will do what is necessary to separate you from that sin. And sometimes it's not pretty, but he will do it. And he can certainly do that in this situation. So I agree. Any other comments before we move on? All right. Oh, here's a map. So maps are always good. I wish Bill was here because he appreciates maps. But here's Samson's hometown in Zora in Dan. And he travels over here to Timnah again to see his wife. And then we'll come back to this map in a little bit. As you can see, maybe Philistia was bigger than this even at this time. All right, question number two, and this will be for Lauren. My thought on this was this chapter is going to reveal the thoughts and the intents of the heart, the thoughts and the intents of the tribe of Judah and Israel is going to be revealed by their behavior. Okay, question two is, how did Samson take his revenge? Why was this so devastating, Lauren?
How did he take his revenge? Part A, he tied the torches to 300 foxes. So I'm not quite sure if this is 150 pair or 300 individual foxes. I couldn't quite figure that out. And let them loose in the sandy grain fields. So this causes a huge fire. As your picture showed earlier, most people think these foxes are more likely jackals. That might make it a little easier that jackals are a pack, more tending to be a pack, but still, that would still be a big feat in catching 300 jackals. They seem to be kind of like coyote is what mm-hmm. a jackal seems to be like. Why was this particularly a devastating act? So it destroyed the food supplies. And grain, especially, because it could be stored up, for an extended period of time. And I think, it talks about destroying the vineyards and the groves and so forth. So in the beginning, it says this is wheat harvest time. So they were just about ready to glean the wheat, and they were really counting on this at this time. They worked all year up to this point, and they were ready to get it, and they thought they had it. And here comes these foxes.
Right. Very good. Other thoughts on this act of wartime vengeance? This is what nations at war do to each other, right? You burn the enemy's crops, you burn their cities. Burn their ability to carry on daily life, and that's what Samson's doing here. Who's going to get blamed for this, and who's going to pay the price for this? It's going to be the Israelites. Who's going to suffer the most from what Samson just did? It's going to be the Israelites. Because the Philistines are the oppressors here, and so they're going to come and take Israelite food. And Israelite supplies. Do you have any grain stored in your basement? I'll take it, thanks. You have any olives? I'll take those. And in fact, anything you got, I'm going to take it all. So the Israelites are under the gun because of what Samson has done here. Much like the Israelites when Moses said to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh said, "No, and they can't have any more straw." And you might remember what the Israelites said to Moses. Israelites said to Moses, "What are you doing? What kind of deliverer are you, Moses?" It's exactly the same situation. Any other comments? All right, let's move on to question three, and this will be for Malan. What did the Philistines do in retaliation to Samson? What did Samson do back to them? Why was he going to cease after that?
Yeah, so verse 6 talks about, says he burned. They burned the fire, his wife, his father, and I was trying to find out exactly what that means, but I guess maybe it means they died. Probably it's pretty common, but back then, of course, when you burn crops and everything, you burn people as well. So that's kind of what I was thinking that meant. The second part would be the Samson attacked them with great intensity, so basically slaughtered. And then the last part, and then it says, yeah, he would cease after that. This was a little bit tricky for me, but I think maybe today we would say, I'm not going to stop until I get revenge on somebody, and then I'll stop. so it kind of shows that maybe, as Austin was talking earlier, it's kind of personal, but maybe not really, because it just appears I'm going to exact revenge on it, and then I'm just going to be done with it. I think that's kind of what I was referring to.
Other comments, Austin?
I really, really agree with Malin there, and I kind of took it that maybe the Philistines, that the burning of her and her father weren't incidental to the burning, that it was very, very intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Samson is not just some wild-eyed, quick-to-anger maniac that just blows everything up and leaves destruction in his wake. And this is proof of that, because he's retaliating for the sin of burning people alive. And he says, after I do this, I'm going to stop. Yeah. And he talk about self-control. Like, even though he's there to deliver Israel, he is the deliverer, he takes vengeance first because of the harm done to his wife. And again, as we've talked about, that's the Lord's doing. They go back and retaliate and do a horrible action, truly horrendous action. He shows his self-control and his ethics and his understanding of his role as well. He's not just going around blowing people up, but he's very calculated in what he does. And he has a very distinct sense of right and wrong. And that can't be overlooked or can't be tossed aside by any stretch of the imagination.
Very good. I agree. Very calculated on his part. A point I missed from the last section with the jackals, the 300 jackals. I thought about this some, and then I found a commentator that commented on this. And why 300 jackals? And the commentator said, it's a comparison with Gideon. Gideon had 300 soldiers with torches that shouted the sword of the Lord and Gideon. So he had 300 men at his back. Who does Samson have at his back? 300 guys. And so, again, he's utterly alone, and now the Philistines have removed any chance of him being reunited with the woman that he loves. And so he is going to exact vengeance on them. And he attacks them hip and thigh with great slaughter. And then he goes up to dwell in the cleft of the rock of Edom. And this hip and thigh comes from Jacob. I wasn't really aware of that. And then I started looking at the etymology of what does it mean to attack someone hip and thigh. And it comes from Jacob. Jacob wrestled with the angel of the Lord all night long, and then the angel dislocated his hip, and Jacob held on to him until he would bless him. And the idea is of a great wrestling match, a great destruction. And you know, you might remember Genesis 32, where this happens, that because the angel had touched Jacob in his hip, the Israelites would not eat the hidden flesh; they would only eat the thigh. So this was well known. This was an idiom among the Israelites, and it means that Jacob waded into the murderers of his wife and of his father-in-law with great savagery. And I have to think those 30 companions were still around, and probably that best man too. I think that best man was visiting, you know, when this happened. Of course, you got to think, what did the best man think about all of this, that his wife was burned up? Again, this he went to dwell in the cleft at Edom. There is a comparison with Moses here. After Moses ordered the slaughter of 3,000 Israelites by the hand of the Levites, remember the golden calf incident? 3,000 Israelites died that day. Moses needed encouragement, and in Genesis 33, God put him in the cleft of the rock. So Moses was beset by doubt because of warfare and bloodshed, and he needed God to show him his glory, and God put him in the cleft of the rock. And here we have Samson in the cleft of the rock as well. So we have a throwback. Samson has a throwback to Jacob, the patriarch of Israel, and a throwback to Samson as well. Etam, let's see if I put the map in there. I think I did. Yeah. So Samson, this is probably up here. I read an article about where were these grain fields. They were probably north of Timnah in this area here. So after these burn, hundreds and hundreds of square miles burn, Samson heads to Etam, which is over here in Judah, right? So he crosses out of Philistine territory through the tribe of Dan, and then just over into Judah. And that brings us then, do we have other comments? Yes, Levi.
This is just the same thing that you were saying, but it's, I guess it's more related to question one, but I like what you were saying about Samson being so alone and how the only person that could potentially keep company with him, his wife, he works through his pride, and he's out there and he brings a goat, and then they just burn her alive. And so he's like, really, there's nobody else to keep him company or share anything with him, and now it's only him and God, right? So I just, I know I like that you drew that out, because it really makes you think about it, you know, how Samson must be feeling. And it kind of leads to why later he turns to women in chapter 16, is because he's just so broken down by this point.
Right.
But
anyway. And Satan uses that as a way to cause him to sin. Certainly, I think that's right. Yeah, I just see Samson as a very lonely person. There was no one. His parents had opposed him. His brothers apparently opposed him. His people oppose him, and as we're about to see here in the next question, the men of Judah betray him. Other comments? All right, so let's go to question four. Why are the men? So the men of Judah come up. The Philistines, again, the Philistines come over an army. We're not told the size of the army. We're told 1,000 were killed, but we're not told the size of the army. They come and deploy themselves against Judah, and that's not good, as you might imagine, and they want Samson captured and delivered to them, and 3,000 men of Judah go to Samson and say, we're going to take him into captivity. So the question is, why are the men of Judah going to arrest Samson rather than defend him and overthrow the Philistines? Could their attitude be a reason why Samson acts alone in the deliverance of Israel rather than with an army of judges, like judges, with an army like judges, other judges before him, I guess. And that would be for Logan.
Yeah, so as we've been saying a little bit about Judah already, you know, they're kind of cowardly in this regard. I mean, you know, they have a right to be afraid of the Philistines, right? You might say that, you know. They've been harassed by them for years and years and years. But all of their food has been burnt just now, or at least a good portion of it. So now seems as good of a time as ever to start up the warpath, you know, and reclaim your freedom and your sovereignty. But they choose not to. They get scared, and they, you know, go with Samson and try to turn him in. So you said that at the beginning. You know, they admire their chains, like Israel does, you know, several times in the previous scripture. So that's the reason why. And as for the second part, Samson acts alone because, like we've been saying, that's all he can do. You know, there's no verse saying he tries to go and raise an army. It might just be a foregone conclusion at this point that's just not going to happen. I don't know. That's
yeah.
My answer.
Well, his first act was to seek a bride among the Philistines.
Yeah.
And that, of course, did not play well in town. Other thoughts on what about the super courageous men of the very courageous men of Judah said, do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? What is this you have done to us? And I like Daniel Block. Daniel Block said that Judahites would rather deliver their countrymen into the hands of the enemy and live under the enemy's domination than fulfill the mandate God had given them to occupy the land and drive out the enemy. The Judahites are willing not only to substitute the rule of the Philistines for the rule of God, but also to sacrifice the divinely appointed leader to preserve the status quo. I thought that was a good comment from Daniel Block. Anyone else? Yes, awesome.
It is. That's really good. John Gill made a comparison here with Samson with Jesus, as it would turn out later, because in much the same way, Jesus is met with a mob of soldiers in the wilderness. They bind him and they turn him over to the Gentiles and deliver him in order to maintain their own power. And he's rejected by his own nation. Yeah, there you go. No king but Caesar. And also interesting, unlike Jephthah before him, again, the character of Samson really shines through, I think, in this chapter. Jephthah, we read just a couple of chapters ago, has a civil war against the men of Ephraim who are coming up against him, and he has his army, and of course, many thousand men die. And Samson could have easily not been captured. Even as Jesus was, he could have called 10,000 angels to his aid. Samson had the Spirit of the Lord on his side. He could have not been captured. But instead of even pronouncing judgment upon them and correcting them in their error, and maybe the judgment even being their own slaughter, he instead preserves them. And I think that's quite something too. And the same thing with Jesus, obviously. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of similarities there.
Comparisons. Exactly. Yeah, as the men of Israel should have read this account in the day of Christ, and Caiaphas should not have said, "It is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, not the whole nation." It's like he lived 1,000 years before and he's just quoting somebody else. Because that's exactly what the men of Judah are doing. One man should die, turning over their Redeemer to the Jews. And again, there's a comparison with Moses, and said this already, but you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. Isn't that great? You're the deliverer, and you know, what have you done to us? And that's, you know, sort of the bad attitude that we hope we don't have. Other comments? Yes, Trace.
I was just going to say, we can all see it. It's kind of a pattern of Israel declining. You can see as the judges, you know, now we're at Samson, he's all alone. You know, at first they kind of had a little support, but now they're like, it's just Samson.
Yeah.
Like Jephthah, he had a little bit, mm-hmm. and reckless man, and you know,
yeah,
it's just worse and worse.
Right. Yeah. And the, you know, the deliverers, weren't always accepted immediately. Jephthah is a perfect example of that. But eventually they were, because they were successful in fighting. But Samson is never accepted. All right, we're getting low on time, so let's move to question 5, which will be for Landon. Why did the Spirit of the Lord come upon Samson at that moment? Are there any special meanings to the words of Samson? What does the name Ramoth Lehi mean?
So for the first part of this question, we saw the same thing happen in the last chapter when Samson goes down to Ashkelon to kill the 30 men. It says the same thing. And I take this just to mean that it's kind of emphasizing that the Spirit of the Lord is on Samson. It's showing that God is giving him the strength needed in order to accomplish this feat. I know there's discussion about whether or not it means the Spirit of the Lord was coming and going on Samson last week, but I think this is just showing that the Lord is empowering Samson to have the strength. That's what mightily means. It's giving him the correct amount of strength to accomplish this. For the second question, I think I'm going to leave it to you to explain what this is, but I'll just leave it as Samson is making a pun here in his words, and then what does the name Ramoth Lehi mean? Well, it means Jawbone Hill.
Very good. Lauren?
Yes, we have to admire Samson.
You want me to put it up there? That's from Kaufman. With the jawbone of an ass, I have piled them in a mass. And James Moffat is the one who translated it that way. And it rhymes in Hebrew. It's a pun in Hebrew, and in English, we don't get it, but James Moffat translated it pretty closely. I'm sorry, go ahead.
For the first part of the question, so I'm going to have a little sympathy for the people of Judah at this point. So, the Spirit of the Lord comes on Samson at this time, and they're taking him up to the Philistines. So, it seems to me that this is Samson's moment to demonstrate that he has the Spirit of the Lord, because this is the time that the other people of Israel get to see the supernatural power of Samson, because he breaks these bonds in a way that they know the Spirit of the Lord is on him at this point. Prior to this, it's unclear to me if they would have known about the feet of the foxes, you know, and so forth, how much of that they would have known, or that they would have just seen him as kind of a spoiled kid that wanted a Philistine wife. You know, I don't know how much they would have known, but here, at this point, they know. And at this point, after this, he becomes the judge of Israel. So, I think that's possibly one of the reasons why the Spirit of the Lord is
very good. There's a slight problem with that, though, because, and it's an interesting take, but as they hand him over, he breaks his bonds, he begins killing Philistines. There's no better moment than for a young David who's in the crowd, or a squad of Israelites, to say, our deliverer is taking action, let's back him up. And then you charge into battle, and you join Samson in the battle. And they had to have run away at this point. So, yes.
Later on in Samuel, we see that the Philistines have deprived them of, there's no blacksmith in the land of Israel. So these guys probably didn't have any swords, any spears,
right,
anything like that. And they probably didn't know how to use the jaw on that one.
Yeah. But of course, they could have picked up weapons from the dead guys. I'm just saying, to me, and we can agree to disagree, but it's pretty craven at this point. I'm just glad they didn't attack Samson themselves. They were obviously behaving rather cowardly in this. Other thoughts before I get my little spiel?
Well, in verse 14, it says, when he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him, and then the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him. So, in one sense, I really like your take, Lauren, because, that would be the perfect moment to display that. But it's interesting that it says that he came up and not they brought him up. So I wonder if maybe they tied him, and I don't know, maybe there was a specific point where they turned him loose, or at a spot where they knew the Philistines would pick him up. I don't know.
They were already at Lehi, though. Hmm? Lehi is the location they were at.
Oh, Lehi?
He was hiding in Lehi. Lehi is
Oh, that's right. They deployed themselves against Lehi in verse 9. So,
right.
So I don't know why it says that he came to Lehi.
I just think it's saying...
Or did he come alone?
Yeah. No, why would he come alone? He obviously would flee. You wouldn't let your prisoner... It's certainly possible.
Anyway.
Yeah. So let me see what else I've got here. So you asked what the meaning of Ramoth Lehi means, and Ramath means hill, Lehi means jawbone, and it has essentially the same meaning as Golgotha. So Golgotha is Skull Hill. You've made some comparisons with Jesus already. Jesus being betrayed by, they knew he was the Messiah, by the way. If you're drawing a straight comparison between Jesus being betrayed by the Jews, they knew he was the Messiah. They were rejecting him. And so I can't imagine they didn't know that Samson was the Messiah and had heard of his exploits. The Philistines knew of his exploits already. And they knew enough of his exploits that they were coming up against him. And so, to me, this is a direct comparison between the sacrifice of Jesus on Skull Hill and the battle of Samson on Jawbone Hill. Because they both are betrayed, they're both bound, and they're both victorious. They were both victorious on these hills. And we're going to find in this next passage here that they both said, I thirst. And they're both revived. Other thoughts? All right, let's move on to question six. What do these verses show us about the faith of Samson? What might it tell us of God's opinion of Samson? Are there any similarities about this miracle that others found in the Bible? Levi.
These verses show us about the faith of Samson. Yeah, I think these are interesting questions because this whole chapter and everything we've seen so far shows a lot of Samson's faith. I was just making a second ago of how he, in the chapter before this, keeps his word to all the Philistines there. And so throughout all this, Samson is trusting in God. And we can see that. We've already talked about a lot how he's alone here. And, you know, we're social creatures, and so we want people to be behind us. Kind of like how people were behind Gideon. They said the whole thing about Gideon and the sword of the Lord. And everybody rushed and everybody loved Gideon. Gideon, you know, it's like, oh, and then had a ton of wives. Samson doesn't get to do any of that. And so he just has great faith in the Lord. So even though he's alone, he continues in what he's doing. And so particularly about this verse, about him asking for water, yeah, me and Dad, we were talking about this in the car, but this is like this is an interesting situation because he's fighting all these men, and it does sound a bit brash to us. We were talking about that, how when we read it, it does sound a bit brash, a little bit sassy, I guess you could say. And now I shall die of thirst and fall on my hand and be circumcised, like he's questioning God. I think, yes, it was a little bit brash, but we have to take into account God has mercy. And Samson has shown great faith here. And part of the faith that he said, that sounds like from these verses, is he's saying, he's asking God for water. He knows none of what he's doing is by himself. And he's saying, God, can I have some water, please? Because he's going to die, he's going to water. What might it tell of God's opinion of Samson? Shows that he has mercy on Samson, even though this might have been a little bit brash, but maybe that's not even a problem, because maybe that's just the translation that we're reading, the way it was translated, I don't know. But God split the hollow place, and water came out to drink, so it shows that God is on Samson's side, even though he is a flawed individual. And, you know, the Bible never writes literature like this, where Samson's this moral gray area character who does a lot of bad stuff. I don't think the Bible would write a story like that. I think if Samson was a bad dude, the Bible would talk about him like that. But no, God said, since the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him multiple times and he gets water here, God gives him water. Are there any similarities about this miracle to others found in the Bible? You mentioned how Moses struck the rock. That's interesting. That's another reason I don't think this is saying bad things about Samson, because I don't think there would be so many points of comparison between Samson and Christ and previous patriarchs too, like Moses, water coming out of the rock. What's the other one? Yeah, ignoring his own friends and his enemies, both obviously ignoring him in this time of peril. That's exactly how it went for Jesus. So, also, yeah, you pointed out how Jesus said, I thirst, on the cross. The hill, the name of the hill, they're both on similar hills, and they both say, I thirst. And you point out how Jesus did get me, but Samson did get me water. So I just thought it was interesting.
You know, it just occurred to me as you were speaking that Samson says, why have you done this to allow me to die? And what does Jesus say to God? Jesus says to God, why have you forsaken me? I mean, to me, those are parallels. Samson says, why have you done all this through my life, and now I'm about to die? And Jesus said, why have you forsaken me? So, to me, I think, again, another parallel is found in this story. Other thoughts? Yes, brother.
A few more Jesus parallels. As we said before, Jesus was delivered into the hands of the Gentiles, but then he overcame all the forces of wickedness that were around him, and his body was not allowed to see corruption as he was revived. Jesus, of course, revived on the third day, a figure in which we are saved by watery baptism, Jesus also gives living water that turns into a spring or a spring with him. So there you go. Flow, rivers of living water. There's a couple of similarities there. And even the name that he names it is En Hakor, I believe, which means spring of the caller, right? So this is the amount of references alone, and this is the same with big events in the Bible. The amount of references to and from it are incredible, like right. Noah or Moses or right. any of them. So this is a big deal.
Jesus on our behalf is called upon the Father and has delivered us into salvation and given us eternal water. Other comments? Because we're out of time. I don't even know if we should read this. But this is what people say. And this is the word biblical commentary. We've seen Samson's braggadocio character. His determination to do what's right in his own eyes, his self-centered actions that ignore his vows, bring guilt on his parents, and his gullibility in dealing with women. The man groomed before God was born to be an immortal example and a military deliverer is now immoral, self-centered, with no thought for his family or religious. And just the exact opposite, I think, of what Samson is. And I made this list sort of summarizing what we've said. The parallels between Samson and Jesus. An elaborate annunciation of their birth. They both begin a judgeship at a wedding and a ministry at a wedding. Samson wanted a Gentile bride. Jesus seeks Gentile converts. Samson spoke in riddles, Jesus in parables. Samson was separated to God on the outside as a Nazarite and did not violate his vows. Jesus was entirely separated and sinless. Samson sent forth foxes two by two with fire. Jesus sent forth disciples two by two with gospel fire. Samson bound and betrayed by the men of Judah, same for the Lord. A great victory on Jawbone Hill, great victory on Skull Hill. Samson said, I thirst, he was revived. Father said, I thirst, and he was resurrected. They called forth the water of life. The gates, next chapter, gates of Gaza do not prevail, the gates of hell do not prevail. They were both betrayed and sold for silver. Samson was blinded and tortured. Jesus was blindfolded and tortured. Samson fought alone against his enemies. Jesus stood alone against his disciples, even forsook him. And Samson collapsed the temple of paganism, and Jesus brought down the temple of the Jews. To me, it's very clear. And the great thing about this is it was written 1,000 years before Christ walked the earth. If you want absolute proof that the scripture is from God, then you look at the narrative of Samson. Because Samson is a shadow of Christ. Like all the deliverers. All the deliverers in the book of Judges have been in some way. That's the point of the book of Judges is here's some flawed deliverers that have come to redeem Israel. But there's one coming that's not flawed. And he will redeem spiritual Israel. So what a blessing we have in this narrative of Samson.